Hey there, Yag here. Before we jump into the show today, I have some exciting news to share. As of this month, we are officially part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. This means we are now part of the leading B2B podcast network designed to help professionals like you get inspired, learn, and grow. The ABM Conversations podcast is now alongside other great podcasts like My First Million with Sam Parr and Sean Puri, The Salesman with Will Barron, and I Digress with Troy Sandridge. Check out all these shows and more at HubSpot.com/podcast network. And now to the show.
Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss how to get closer to your customers and what triggers people to buy so that you can market smarter. To discuss that, today we have with us the customer whisperer, the amazing Caitlin Burgoyne. Caitlin is the CEO and lead trainer at Customer Camp and the host of The Customer Show, a marketing podcast that explores what makes people tick, click, and buy. She's a growth strategist, trainer, and a three-time founder who was named in the Forbes list of top female influencers. And that is not all. Her tweets, newsletter, and every piece of content comes with years of marketing wisdom from being in the trenches. With that, Caitlin, welcome to the show. I'm super happy to have you here.
I'm so delighted to be here, and I really appreciate that introduction. It's always weird hearing your own bio, and you just did such a beautiful job. Thank you. I hope I can live up to that.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it took a lot of time for me to have you on the show. Rand was like, you should definitely have Caitlin, and I'm so happy that you're finally here.
I'm delighted to be here. Can't wait to chat.
Absolutely. Right. Let's get started. You know, let's begin with psychology 101, because everybody in marketing talks about how marketing is all about understanding human psychology. While a lot of experts say marketing equals psychology, they don't tell you how exactly to apply it. And we being in the same ecosystem, I know you're not a big fan of leaving ideas in the dark. You like to test the hypothesis in the real world and see if it really works. So according to you, what is the synergy between marketing and psychology, and how can marketers leverage this?
Great question, Yag. And it's one that I wish, to be truly honest, that I would have discovered and started implementing my work much, much sooner. So right. Well, I've been an entrepreneur for about 11 years, working in marketing for 12. I jumped right in early in my career. I decided to start freelancing and then grew an agency and eventually, you know, working with some cool clients like Target and Holiday Inn. But at the time, years ago when I was running my agency, this was not the foundation to the work we would do. And it's only in reflection, you know, having gone through the journey I've gone through with other entrepreneurial ventures, to really get to this place where it's like, okay, the most important thing is understanding why people buy. And that sounds simple enough, but it's often not that easy to get those answers. And it takes time and it takes effort. And like you said, it takes experimentation. We can have the most brilliant ideas in the world, and we can have a good sense of how people make decisions, both from a buyer psychology perspective and from doing our own customer research. But you still need to experiment with things, and you still need to try things and test messages. And so I didn't always work this way. And what I'd say is that it's hard lessons that have brought me to making this the focus of everything we do at Customer Camp. But really what I discovered after closing down my own tech company, so I started a tech business, things looked great from the outside. We were growing quickly. We raised venture capital. We were being called the next LinkedIn by Forbes and Inc. magazine. And from the outside, everyone's like, whoa, you guys are crushing it. And it certainly did not feel like that internally. And it was not going that well internally. So we had, you know, we were pretty good on the acquisition side of getting people to discover the platform. My marketing background, my PR background came in handy there. but we hadn't built the right product, and people would join the network and they would check it out, but they weren't coming back again and again. They weren't telling their friends. That's really the stink of death for a network. So we couldn't figure that out in time and ended up shutting down that business. And kind of to make a long story short to how I got to where we are now, I was fortunate enough that in shutting down that business, I'm trying to figure out what the heck am I going to be when I grow up. And our lead investor, who had been the lead investor in that company, came to me and said, "All right, you guys, you were really good on the marketing side of things. We have a bunch of teams who are much better on the product side of things. They're great at building products. The products that they have, people really like, but they're having a really hard time getting people to know about them. And maybe you could do some work with them and help them to get more customers." And I was like, "Okay, cool. Like, I'll do that, especially if you're going to pay me." So I went and I got to sit down with all of these brilliant entrepreneurs, very often technical teams, and learned pretty quickly in sitting down at the boardroom table with them that a lot of them weren't clear on who their best customers were. And there was arguments at the, you know, at the head of leadership around like, "Well, we're going after this audience, but also kind of this one's in our view and this one and this one." Or I would hear just very vague answers around the customer. So, you know, we sell to companies who sell their products online with anywhere between 10 and 500 employees, which essentially is like almost every company. So it became clear that people just didn't know who their customers were, and that was holding them back from designing the right solutions and also from being able to acquire more customers. And that led me to the work that I do today. And the more work I did and the more I discovered about working with companies who were just trying to grow and having this lack of insight into who their customers were, oftentimes they didn't know who they were. And even if they did have a sense of who they wanted their customers to be, they didn't understand why those people bought. And they didn't understand what would make them buy from them versus a competitor, and how to craft really compelling marketing materials and offers that would get them to click and buy and tell their friends. And so that became the impetus for what we do now.
Wow. You know, that story brings a whole lot of painful memories of me closing down some of my past couple of companies. And I was going in every direction. I can so resonate to, you know, your journey. You know, some of the experts that we've had on our show have spoken about the importance of knowing who is buying your product. But, you know, they are often talking about it from the standpoint of if people are referring the product to their network. In short, they are pointing towards product market fit. Mm-hmm. But when I look at the Caitlin Touch, you know, you talk about adding another nuance to it where you say, let's look at why are they actually buying it. It's almost like saying, let's look at the product emotion fit, if I can coin such a term. So let me ask you this. Would you say why is more important than the who? In that sequence, would you place why first?
Absolutely. So it's why, and also when. When is the one that I think is really exciting that a lot of marketers kind of gloss over when it comes to choosing target audiences. So think about your own buying journey with any product. There was a moment that happened, I call this a trigger event, that took mm-hmm. you from not knowing you had a problem or not having a problem to realizing, okay, I have a problem I need to solve. I have a job I'm trying to get done. And now I might be receptive to a message about a product or solution like this. Those trigger events, those happen in our customers' lives, and there are common ones that happen across our customers' lives. And when we talk to customers and we learn their buying stories, we can discover those trigger events. And I think one of the mistakes that a lot of marketers make, and of course I've made this mistake myself, is we're so obsessed with who the target customer is, but that doesn't actually explain why that customer buys or when that customer might be likely to buy from us. So we look at things like the demographic information of, you know, whether it's a man or a woman, do they live in cities, do they have kids? And if you're B2B, of course, your listeners are B2B, we're looking at the firmographic information, like how big is the company that they work for and what's their job title and have they recently raised funds and
existing tech landscape and all of that.
Exactly. Well, yeah. You know, what's their tech stack, all of that kind of stuff. But that doesn't explain why we buy things. We don't buy right. things because of job titles. We buy things because something happened in our real world that made us go from this isn't a problem to this is a problem. And it's a problem that I need to solve now. And when marketers and salespeople can discover what these trigger events are, it can be incredibly powerful. There's a great thought leader on this. He focuses on the sales side of things, and I come at it from an approach around marketing. But Craig Elias talks about this, and he gives lots of stats from the sales perspective. He's written a great book called Trigger Event Selling. And essentially, when you can figure out what those trigger events are, then you know how to look for them. So let me give you a story of an example from my own business.
Sure.
So I have this little product. It's called the Clarity Call Cheat Sheets. And what it is essentially, it's a how-to guide on interviewing customers. No surprise, I'm a big nerd for learning from your customers. And I think one of the best sure. ways to learn from them is to ask them why they bought your thing. So we can do all of this sophisticated stuff. We can have all of these cool, you know, audience intelligence tools, and there's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. But oftentimes they are used in replacement for just actually having a conversation with somebody. You know, you can collect thousands of survey responses, but the depth that you can get from a one-on-one conversation with a customer who recently bought from you, you just can't get that in any other method. And so it's one of my favorites. And so we created this resource called the Clarity Call Cheat Sheets, which is essentially a guide for how to run really strong interviews, how to ask the right questions, how to get people to say yes to talking to you, how to summarize what you're hearing, so you can share it with your team, all that kind of stuff. So it's this great little resource. And I, of course, being somebody who eats my own dog food, go out and I interview my own buyers, right? I want to learn why did they buy this product? What was going on in their world that triggered them to have a problem where suddenly they were looking for a solution like this? And from doing a good number of interviews, I started to see a pattern. And one of the patterns, one of the common patterns for people beginning the journey towards buying this product was that it was a marketer for hire. Either they work at an agency or they're a freelance consultant, and they start working with a client and they sit down and they realize very quickly, similar to what I did back when I was doing this work myself, that their client doesn't really know who their audience is. And it becomes this bottleneck for them. They're not able to feel confident in their strategy and approach because the client can't provide the information that they need to market effectively. And so this was happening to marketers for hire when they'd start working with new clients. And it was happening for in-house marketers. They'd join a team, they would get really excited with a new role, and then very quickly have this oh no moment where they realize, oh crap, like, we really don't know who the customer is, and I need to do some of this foundational work. And that moment, that trigger event, is what would lead them to eventually buying the cheat sheets. So for the, you know, in one of the interviews, the person went and they looked for other solutions to try to solve the problem. They got a persona template first, and they tried filling that out with the client. Well, guess what? If the client doesn't really understand their buyer, everything they tell you to put in that persona template is probably not going to be that helpful. So that was, yes. You know, that was one of the things that they did before actually finding their way to me and the cheat sheets. What's so awesome about discovering these trigger events and discovering, you know, what is it, what's the job that the person's trying to get done, and what alternate solutions have they considered or tried or even bought, is that you as a marketer can suddenly figure out how to get in front of people who are more likely to be in the market for a solution like what you're offering. So with this example, one thing that I'm working on right now is I've got a blog post in the hopper. By the time this episode airs, it'll probably be live. And it's a blog post where I'm going to target people who are actually looking for a persona template, because I know that those people are likely to be in the journey to better understand their buyers, and that our cheat sheets would be a great solution for them. And I wrote this whole blog post called Fuck Personas, Use Trigger Tests to Drive Growth Faster, where I lay out our framework for how you can use these trigger events to come up with these really targeted growth campaign ideas. And so I'm going to do Google AdWords to get in front of people looking for a buyer persona, because those are the right people, the people who would be a good fit for our cheat sheets. So I'm really geeky about the power of trigger events, because they allow us to get in front of not just the right people, but the right people at the right time. And as marketers, we know how important that is, because we don't need to write another blog post that gets awesome traffic And a ton of those people have no interest in ever buying a solution like we offer. So I think we spend too much time as marketers trying to justify our efforts. And I think it's a lot better when we can say, this is what we're doing. Here's why, because we want to get in front of people who've experienced this trigger. And we know that they're already looking at other solutions like this. And that's why we're doing this thing. You can really argue for your ideas to your team and get them to get excited about your ideas because they're based on real customer stories, and not just the latest tactic or, you know, channel that's hot right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is trigger events are any day better than saying Mary the marketer drinks coffee in the morning.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I don't think any of us have ever bought a product because we love dogs or because of our age. Yet that seems to be the thing that's most prominent in all of these personas.
Yeah, absolutely. And from whatever you said, you know, it also seems that there's one more factor that we have in common, that is the love and passion for the jobs to be done framework. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm a huge fan of the framework. We had Bob Moesta some time back doing an entire episode on it. And my company, Avoma, literally has jobs to be done as a philosophy for our conversation intelligence platform. But what I find interesting is that, you know, you look at it as an innovative framework for marketers and not just for product teams. Mm-hmm. And I fundamentally agree with that thought process, but I think it'll be really interesting for our audience if you can give us an example, preferably your firsthand experience, maybe even a hypothetical one, mm-hmm. on how marketers can leverage JTBD.
I love that question. And so I was recently talking with another marketer, and they too, like your organization, have just invested a lot of time in figuring out jobs. And so they spent 2 months doing interviews and really narrowing down the different jobs to be done for their product. And he said to me afterwards, he's like, the challenge that I have sometimes with jobs is that it can be so macro. And as a marketer, I don't really know, how do I really action it, right? How do I figure out how to take what I've identified as the job the customer's trying to get done and how I can leverage that for creating marketing campaigns and driving strategy and ideas. And so I showed him the trigger technique framework, which again is this new concept that I'm just about to popularize now. And very, very much inspired by Bob Moesta's work. Actually, Bob will be one of the first people that will read this new post. I've got a amazing. I'm going to be chatting with him later this week about it. But for me, I had that similar challenge where I found jobs to be so informative from a theoretical perspective, yet I struggled to figure out how to make it obviously actionable. And what I believe that kind of has crystallized with the trigger technique is essentially, if you go out and you get these four pieces of information from your customer, so the four pieces of information you want is you want to know what was the trigger event that led them to begin the buying journey? What was the overarching job they're trying to get done? What alternative solutions did they consider, try, or buy? And where did those things fall short? And then what was the selfish benefit? Because again, when we're thinking about why people buy, there's often the kind of like more functional thing, like in the event, in the case of marketers, marketers want to quickly figure out what works with an audience, right? That's their job to be done. Yeah. And they think that putting together a persona is going to help with that, but it often falls short for a number of reasons. They think that, you know, running a survey is going to help, but that can fall short for a number of reasons. And there's lots of reasons why that's a challenge to do. But the selfish benefit for them, right? The selfish benefit is that they want to feel more confident in the campaigns that they recommend. They want to look good to their teams and their clients, right? Those are the things that oftentimes can really be the underlying motivations. And so understanding those selfish benefits is so important, especially in B2B. So those are your four pieces. I call them the cornerstone insights. You need to know the trigger event, the job, the other solutions that they considered and why those things didn't work. And you need to know their selfish benefits. When you get those four pieces and, you know, picture a Venn diagram of those four things overlapping, you can figure out some pretty interesting stuff that is really critical for marketers. So first of all, when you know the trigger event and the job, you can figure out the target market because you can ask yourself, well, who has a trigger event like this? And when might they experience that job to be done? Who are those people? And that can help you to figure out not just who, but as I said, when. When you know what the job is that they're trying to get done, and you know what alternate solutions they've considered, that can help you figure out what channels you might want to explore to get in front of them. I'll give you a practical example of this in a minute. When you understand what the alternate solutions are that they're considering and what the selfish benefits are, well, that can help you to really shape a compelling message because you can share why your solution is a great fit. And you can contrast that with alternatives that they might have considered that they had challenges with. You can show why you're better. And when you understand the selfish benefits that they want to achieve, and you know what that trigger event is, you can really come up with a strong call to action. All of this can lead to a great campaign idea that's really driven by customer stories as opposed by, you know, gut instinct or guessing. So let me give you an example. So I did a customer interview with somebody who had recently bought the product BarkBox. Are you familiar with BarkBox?
No, I'm not.
No. So it's a subscription service for dog owners. And essentially every month you get this box full of things for your dog. You can get treats and toys.
Yes,
and
yes. I think I've heard about this. Were they on Shark Tank or something?
Maybe. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. They certainly are getting well known and doing fairly well from a marketing perspective. But so I did an interview with somebody who'd recently bought BarkBox. And what I discovered was that the trigger event for her that had led her to begin the buying journey, whether or not she realized that at the time, was that she had a puppy. They had a puppy. He was about 4 months old. And then she got pregnant for the first time. And she go in her back of her mind, she's going, oh, okay. So now we weren't planning to get pregnant. We're very excited that we're going to be parents, but it wasn't something that we were planning. And we've got this puppy. And now I'm going to have a real baby in addition to having our like dog baby. And so that trigger event was the thing that, whether she knew it at the moment or not, really started that buying journey. And of course, then the baby came, and babies are a handful. I know this from experience. I recently had one. And she quickly saw that she needed some help. So the job she had to get done was she wanted to keep her dog entertained and distracted because she didn't have as much time as she used to have to take care of the dog. So some of the alternate solutions that she used to use, things like taking the dog for a long walk, well, that was harder now that she had a stroller in tow, or, you know, putting the dog in the car and taking them to the dog park to try to get them to run off all of their energy. Again, harder. You have to bundle up a baby. It's the middle of the winter, get them in the car. Not the easiest thing in the world. She even tried having her brother bring his dog over and put the two of them outside so they could play together. But that actually doubled her workload instead of making it less. And so she tried all of these alternate solutions. And at the same time, being a new mom, she's spending a lot of time sitting on social media, kind of scrolling with phone in one hand and a baby's head breastfeeding in the other in the middle of the night, right? And so she said during the interview, you know, when I pressed her on what it was that had driven her to buy and kind of like what that selfish benefit might be, she said she wanted to get rid of her dog mom guilt. So she had all of this dog mom guilt, which I thought was such brilliant language, because you don't have to be a real mom or a real parent to be a dog parent, right? Lots of people would resonate with that message. So the kind of four pieces there, those cornerstone insights, she had become a parent. She had the job to do of keeping her dog entertained and distracted. That was the job. She tried a bunch of these other solutions that hadn't worked for whatever reason. And she wanted that selfish benefit of relieving her dog mom guilt. When you take those four pieces, you know, a clever marketer can, there's so much good stuff there that you can work with. And so the campaign that we just like on the fly conceptualized just to show people how this works, like imagine if you ran a test where you targeted people with young kids, which you can do quite easily through Facebook ads, and you targeted them and you ran a campaign with influencers on Instagram who are moms, who these mommy bloggers on Instagram, who people like my friend Sarah would have probably been following. And you could get them to share about BarkBox and talk about how happy it keeps their dog and how it keeps them entertained and out of their hair. And you could get them to compare all the things they tried that didn't work, things that are going to resonate and be meaningful to a new mom. And make sure, you know, you don't have to give these influencers total direction. You don't want to script it. You want it to be authentic, but you get them to say, you know, relieved my dog mom guilt. The message is right there, right? You could use those influencers to get in front of the right people. And you could then turn those same organic videos, those kind of like user story videos, into ads. And you could target women who are in these mommy Facebook groups or these massive Facebook groups that moms join when they become a new parent. So you can see how with those four kind of cornerstone insights, you can really get to a very highly targeted test. And, you know, you could call the box, the distraction box, get your first box free. So like really getting at the thing that moms are looking for, which is they want to relieve that dog mom guilt and they want to be able to distract and entertain their pet. Now, the coolest thing about jobs, which you're geeky about it too, is when you think about, well, who else might have that job to be done? Who else might want to keep their dog entertained and distracted because they don't have as much time as they used to be able to take care of that dog? Well, think about when the pandemic happened and suddenly everybody is now working from home, and people who might have taken their pet to the office or might have been able to leave the house to go to work are now working in the same house with their animals. All right. of those people have that same job to be done, and they're probably going to have the same like desire of relieving that dog mom guilt or that dog dad guilt. And so suddenly that one campaign very targeted at moms, that who, you could see how that target could be just as easily applied to people who are now working from home and trying to explain to their dog why they can't play when they're sitting right in front of them. And so the beauty of, like, you know, really using customer interviews to get to know your customer and thinking about things from the triggering events, you know, what's the job to be done, is you can come up with such cool and targeted campaigns as opposed to just saying, you know, fun stuff for your dog. You can really get in front of the right people with very hyper-targeted messages. So this is the stuff I'm really geeky about.
I think it's a good time to take a moment and thank the HubSpot Podcast Network. Being part of the HubSpot Podcast Network means we now have a behind-the-scenes look into the world's number one CRM platform and get to share new information and features that are helping businesses like yours stay connected to their customers, goals, and teams. With improved forecasting tools and custom report builders, you can see how your quarter is going, inspect new deals, and use customizable data-driven reports to improve team performance as you grow. With custom behavioral events, you can track site behavior and understand your customers' buying habits all within the platform. And if you're looking for cleaner data with a centralized system, the all-new Operations Hub Enterprise gives your ops leads the ability to curate datasets for all users, meaning even faster and more consistent reporting. Learn more about how the HubSpot CRM platform can help connect the dots for your business at HubSpot.com. You know, this is absolutely fantastic. And because of your story, what I'm going through right now as I'm listening to this is this learned helplessness phenomenon where I'm feeling guilt as a dad because I have two kids. And, you know, ever since the pandemic, managing the kids and doing my work has been very difficult. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I will remember dad guilt forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about like most toys, and this is what I love about jobs to be done, like most toys that exist before iPads and before TV, they existed to basically distract and entertain children. And that's pretty meaningful if you're a parent that has to do anything other than just watch over your kid all day, which most of us are doing double duty. So it's what I love about jobs to be done, though, is you can start to see where certain products that might promise to deliver on that job do so better than others, because parents know how good the iPod is at doing that job, but they feel a lot of guilt around their kids sitting on a screen all day long. So I love that about jobs to be done. So it is very macro, but the right solution in the right context, that's where we as product designers and marketers really have an opportunity to get so creative.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like finding your ikigai, you know, amongst all those intersections and saying that this is where it all lies.
That's exactly it. And so when this does go live, I'll share a link to the post, but it very much looks like the ikigai. It's these four overlapping circles. And in the center is that trigger test idea. And that comes from finding these key pieces that you can get from even just one interview. One interview with the right person can yield so much great insight, as opposed to marketers just being like, oh, everybody's on Clubhouse now. Well, I guess we should be on Clubhouse.
I've been there. I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right now, you know, 90% of my content actually comes from me listening to our prospects and customers. Even if I'm not directly talking to them, it's about, you know, listening to how they are talking, the kind of questions that they are asking to my account executive, or the kind of conversation happens between my CSM and the customer. And it gives me so much insight as to why people are thinking. And if I have not been listening to these conversations, I would just be churning out stories where I'm converting a feature into a pain point and a pain point to solution. That doesn't help anyone.
No, it doesn't. And the thing is, I mean, this is a very big topic right now, especially in the world we're in around B2B marketing and SaaS. And it's not difficult to build stuff anymore. The challenge around actually building product has gone infinitely down. And what's going to be compelling for the companies that win, it's going to be the ones who can actually craft a really unique and compelling narrative that matters to customers and explain why they're better. And it's not going to be the features that people compete on. And I think that the customer-focused companies like yourself, like those are going to be the ones who are so much more adept at creating that really compelling narrative than the ones who are just kind of like, well, what do we want to be known for? It's like, well, no, that's not the question. The question is, what do your customers care about? Right. Let that lead.
Right. You know, Caitlin, here's something that I have a strong feeling about, and I would love to hear how you see it. Customer discovery, you know, as such, doesn't seem to be as common as sales discovery, and companies don't realize that it ultimately ends up hurting your product market fit. PM fit, they think, is a one-time thing, but not many people realize that it's a continuously evolving phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've heard these statements like, hey, you know, we don't have time for customer research, or the worst part is we don't want marketers to be talking to customers. And why do you think there is this general resistance to talking to customers in marketing, especially when other teams like product are doing it on a regular basis?
It's a great question. And I've spent actually a lot of time trying to figure out the answer. So right. Back in 2018, I wrote a blog post on Medium called "The Most Powerful Growth Hack of 2019 Isn't Sexy." And that whole post was around the power of audience research. And it kind of went a little bit viral. It got shared by, you know, famous marketers like Rand Fishkin and Andrew Chen and a bunch of big people like VPs from Amazon and Facebook. And, you know, it got lots of fanfare, yet right. 3 years later, it's still not sexy. It's still, you know, it's people, marketers are still having to fight tooth and nail to get buy-in. And I think, you know, again, like having spent a lot of time thinking about this and doing a lot of research, you know, I partnered with Audience, which is an audience intelligence tool. And we did a big research on, you know, audience research with marketers. So very, very meta. But I think what it comes down to is it's slow. And it doesn't always tell you what to do. So I think that is really the challenge that a lot of marketers need to overcome. They need to find a way to make audience research faster, and they need to find a way to make it obviously actionable so that when they gather insight, that insight, it's obvious how they can use that in their workflow. And that's why I think there's so much resistance. I think that oftentimes teams have invested in, you know, in-depth research and have not seen the return. I found, I was chatting with a friend of mine, and she worked for a very big wearables company, one that everybody who's listening would know. And she shared about how they spent 3 months on one of their teams going off and doing focus groups and surveys and all of this research to try to build these personas. 3 months later, they come back with the personas. They share them with the whole marketing team, the sales team, all the folks. And I said, well, what happened next? And she goes, I don't know. They were just never seen again. So I think that I think that the problem why leadership is resistant isn't because leaders are stupid. It's not because they are like just ignoring this wealth of information. It's because the way that it's historically been done has been too slow for the speed at which their business moves and hasn't been all of that helpful considering the investment. And there's a lot of reasons why the way that research is typically done and the way that insights are delivered to teams just isn't working. And one of the big challenges is typically the people who get the most value from the research are the ones that are actually doing the research, right? The ones who are having the conversations. They're getting all of this value. But then translating that into an output that the rest of the team can benefit from as well, so they can get as much value, is hard and it's time consuming. That's why personas were invented, but they do, in my opinion, a pretty crappy job at it. And so that's where there's something else needed, something that is much faster, that doesn't make this huge promise of we're going to definitively tell you who the best customers are, but instead makes a much more realistic promise, which is we're going to learn from customers on an ongoing basis, do it in a way that is really like low friction, and we can share what we learn in a way that everybody gets to benefit from those stories, but it doesn't take a ton of time and energy to basically translate everything you hear in research back to the team and try to put together this huge research report that nobody reads. That's where it's falling short. It's just the way it's historically been done is not helpful. And so the alternative becomes, well, let's go out and gather a bunch of data, or let's analyze competitors' audiences or our audiences and try to find patterns. And that doesn't help either, right?
Yep.
Yep. Like Twitter got rid of their analytics back end. It was funny. I wrote a post a couple of years ago about the best way to do audience research. And one of the tools was Facebook Audience Insights, and Twitter had an analytics tool. And I remember looking at the Twitter, at the results for my audience. And one of the insights that came back, I think it said something about, it might've been about dogs. It might've been about, it was just like this, like just there was data there, but it wasn't useful or actionable. And I think that's why Twitter got rid of it, because they were like, this is where we have this product that we're sharing with advertisers or brand owners that doesn't actually give them anything very helpful. And so they scrapped it. And I think that that's where the change is needed. And that's where, for me, the kind of like the evolution of the work I'm doing now, creating the trigger technique, it's really just designed to make research with, like, you know, using air quotes right now, to make research way faster and to make it easy to share what you learn and to show what you're going to do with it. Because that's the thing that teams care about, is what the heck are we going to do with this, right?
Yeah, yeah. And looking at competitors and merely copying it doesn't help. Like the worst example, I don't know why everybody started doing this. Like say Instagram had stories. Everybody started coming up with stories, Slack and LinkedIn and everyone. And now everybody's also getting rid of it one by one. I don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that their product teams are embarrassed, for one, because like it became like kind of this running joke. I remember when there was a graphic going around of stories in Excel documents.
Yeah, yeah.
That just showed the, you know, how everybody kind of lost their mind a little bit. I know Twitter got rid of them. They had fleets and they got rid of fleets.
Yeah.
And
yeah. LinkedIn has already announced it, that they're going to get rid of it.
They're going to get rid of them too. Yeah. I think the other thing is, like, for most of us, you know, anybody who works in marketing, who's using social media on a day-to-day basis for their, to grow their company and to grow their team's brand, like individual brands, like we don't want another place that we have to write new stories. It's like, God, no, please don't make me have another place where I need to do stories. And so I think that product teams, you know, you can listen to customers, and sometimes listening to customers can lead you astray, which is why I really like jobs, you know, jobs to be done.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to get to that, right? So I never got, what job are we going to get done by posting a story? Mm-hmm. It's neither clickable. Sometimes it is. If you add a link, the visibility goes down. And I'm like, what's the point?
Well, and I also think that the beauty about the dominant social networks that we have today, the ones that are really taken off, is that they sort of all have their own shtick, right? Like, and that's related to the job to be done. Like Twitter is very different than Instagram, and Instagram is very different than YouTube, and YouTube is very different than Facebook. And so there's some overlap between them, of course, but ultimately the people who are there that marketers want to get in front of, who are using these platforms for whatever purposes, they all have their own draw and appeal and use cases that make sense from a marketing perspective. And the more that everybody copies each other, the less attractive these campaigns, these platforms become. And I think the best example of that is Facebook. I mean, most marketers freely admit that they would love to delete their Facebook account if they didn't have to use, and Facebook still has like the best ads platform because they are just so much farther ahead from the other social networks anyway. But most marketers would love to get rid of their personal Facebook account, but can't because they need to be able to have an account to be able to manage an ads account. And it just goes to show you Facebook had, you know, just every potential competitor, they would release something that would be that feature set. And it's become this incredibly bloated, confusing product. And I think LinkedIn is wise to get rid of stories. I think that Twitter's wise to get rid of fleets. I think that they recognize that adding more is not actually delivering more for their users.
Right. You know, we could go on an entire rant on that topic. That's amazing. But here's one more thing that I want to touch. You share a lot of great tips and psychological hacks for your 4,000 plus marketers who subscribe to your newsletter, including quite a few people that I personally know of. And I really like how you pitch your newsletter in public by saying that, you know, it's just going to take about 3 minutes a week, because it's all about those little things or little time that you spend to get one person better every week that compounds mm-hmm. over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring this up is because you talked about the endowment effect in one of your recent newsletter editions. Mm-hmm. And for the benefit of our listeners, if you can elaborate a little bit on what endowment effect is and share some examples, that'd be fantastic.
Sure. So the endowment effect is essentially when we feel ownership over something, we're more likely to care about that thing, and we're going to value it being worth more. So there was this example that they did. A lot of these examples are often done in universities where they study these behavioral economics traits, but they did this experiment with some students, and they had a mug, and half of the students were given the mug. It was a gift that was given to them. They said, "This mug now belongs to you." And the student said, "Okay, thank you. And what do you think the mug is worth?" And those students guessed, said that the mug is worth, let's just say, $4. Then the other half of the students, the ones who were not given the mug, they were told, "Well, how much do you think that this mug is worth?" Now, they didn't own the mug themselves. And they said, "Oh, well, I think it's worth about $2. So the people who actually owned the mug deemed it to be almost two times more valuable than the people who didn't own it. And this is a great thing to know if you're a marketer, because what it shows is that oftentimes we as marketers or product owners, there are things that we think are so valuable because we took a lot of time to make them, or they belong to us, right? So we write a blog post that we spend 25 hours on, and that blog post seems really valuable. Or we release a new feature in our product, one that the team worked on for 2 months, and that seems really valuable to us. But then to the people that we're trying to sell to, or the people that we're trying to market to, oftentimes they're not going to relay the same value to that. And this can really skew perceptions of what things are worth. And there's a really great example of this. So ProfitWell, I have a post on my site where I show the data from this. They did it in a video, so it might be a little trickier to find the video. But essentially, they went out and they asked people. They asked all of these software companies. They asked them, when you release a new feature, how valuable are those new features, and how much does that relate to people being willing to pay more? And of course, all of the teams from these companies said, "Oh, the last feature we released was very valuable and worth paying more for." And then ProfitWell actually surveyed all of the users of those products, which was, of course, a massive research effort. And they asked them, "The last feature that this company released, how valuable was it in that you would pay more for it? And, you know, what did you, like, was it a useful release?" And it was basically like the mirror opposite. They said, "Not valuable, not worth paying more for." Okay. And it just goes to show you that these people, they think that they put out this really great thing because they're not talking to their customers enough. They don't understand their users enough. And that's part of the endowment effect. And that's part of how we as marketers, we might spend a ton of time on that blog post. Maybe we put together this like ultimate guide to X that we think is just so good. And it's absolutely well worth getting people to sign up for. We put together a webinar that we think people, why wouldn't somebody sign up and commit 2 hours of their day to watch this thing? And they should pay us for this thing. It's so darn good. But your audience oftentimes doesn't feel the same value from your products and your marketing that you may as an organization.
Wow. It's like, looking back at the crystal ball and looking at my last 13 years of experience. Amazing.
Oh, me too. Well, the funny thing is I've gone on and on with this blog post. Now, I've been working on this blog post around the trigger technique for a week now. To me, it's this like really, really awesome thing. And it'll be interesting to see as, when I put it out there, are other people going to see how valuable this could be? Are other people going to get as excited about applying this in their business as I am? We will, time will tell. So by the time this goes out, I'll have more of an understanding on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We all will. Right. And now that we are inching towards the 45-minute mark, it's time for us to go to the second section of the podcast, which we call the rapid fire section. And in this section, what I'm going to do is shoot 5 lightning questions at you. The questions mm-hmm. might be short, but your answers need not be. So feel free to say whatever comes to your mind. Are you ready for that?
I'm ready. Yeah.
Awesome. So here's question number 1. What's your favorite nerdy brain fact about human psychology?
Favorite nerdy brain fact. My favorite is probably around anchoring. And so the anchoring is how, like when you present it with information, how it's presented will change how we feel about it. So for instance, this is particularly useful when it comes to pricing. So you'll often see that companies will show 3 different tiers of pricing. Oftentimes one of those is a decoy, one that they don't expect anybody to actually buy, but it's such a high price that it makes the other one look like a great deal. And there's a lot of truth to how effective anchoring can be. So I love using anchoring because I think it really helps us as marketers to choose the right anchor as a comparison for our products and solutions so that people can see the value.
That's awesome. And by the way, I really like your nerdy brain tweets. That they are awesome.
Thank you. That's a new thing we're doing. So it's great. That's great feedback to hear.
Absolutely. Right. So the second question is going to be a little bit tricky. Which one would you never trade off? Your 26,000 followers on Twitter or the 4K subscribers for your newsletter?
Oh, that is a hard one. You said that these are going to be stumpers. I mean, ultimately, Twitter, I don't control Twitter. And, Twitter could ban my account tomorrow and I'd lose access to being able to talk to those people. Trump knows how painful that is. But I also don't control the email management software or the email client that people are using. Some are using Gmail, which probably puts my emails right in their promotions tab and then they have to remember to go. And so I think that marketers talk about email being the thing that you own, but really there's no surefire thing there either. I would say if put on the spot and I had to, I'd say Twitter, because Twitter allows them to talk back and it allows us to share and engage in a way that's just much more scalable than email. And it allows you to really feel like you're having kind of like these fun and effortless conversations with your people. Whereas, of course, email, everybody can hit reply and you want them to, you want to engage there too. But I think that the pace of the conversation and the tone of the conversation is just so much more fun and rapid on Twitter that I think it would be hard to give that up.
Yeah, I love that pick because that's far more, as you said, it's far more, conversational and a lot of other people can also come and chip in.
Mm-hmm, so absolutely. Exactly.
Right. So here's question number 3. What do you think really went wrong with Vendev, your VC-backed tech company that you founded, which was touted to be the next LinkedIn?
Yeah. I mean, how long do you have? So many things. We did so many things. In retrospect,
Maybe you can give your top pick.
Yeah. The top pick, I would say, And of course, this is on me as the CEO. This was a big mistake, but I didn't start the company with a technical co-founder. And I did start it with a technical co-founder, but before we even released, wrote the first line of code, that person had an opportunity to come up for them that meant that they couldn't move forward with working on the company, but I decided to continue to move forward. And so as a non-technical founder, I wasn't able to build the product, and I had a real challenge finding the right people, people who would have as much passion and enthusiasm for what we were doing as a founder might. And I had great people, not to say we didn't have great people on the team, but that would be a big mistake. From the beginning, that kind of set us back. There was a lot of challenges on the product side of things that were expensive. We had to redo the product a couple of times just because of ignorance on my part as a non-technical founder. So I'd say if I had to lean on to the other thing was I didn't know anything about jobs to be done at the time of building the company. And in retrospect, looking back at what the job was that people were actually using our product for, we completely built the wrong thing. And that's part of the reason why I'm so excited about jobs, because I think it allows you to frame value in such a different way. And in retrospect, we could have done things quite differently from day one and not spent a year building the wrong thing if we would have really been able to look at the outcome for our users from the lens of jobs to be done. So that's, I'd say, not having the technical co-founder from day one and not really understanding the job people were trying to get done when they use the platform and therefore building the wrong thing.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, experiences like this help us who the kind of person that we have become today. So absolutely. You can look back at it and say that you've learned a lot from that for sure.
Oh, huge.
Right. So here's question number four. What's your favorite channel for talking to customers? Is it email? Is it phone calls? Is it one-to-one Zoom interviews? Or is it something that is very Caitlin that I'm not able to think of?
It's calls. I mean, I think that ultimately the reason that I love just an audio-only call. Now, I mean, a video is nice too, but what I love about an audio-only call is that it's easier to get people to say yes to that. There's less pressure for them to look nice. You know, there's
sometimes you can walk in the park and still talk.
That's right. That's right. You know, being a new mom, I know how valuable it is to be able to go for a walk for a meeting as opposed to sitting in front of Zoom, because when my baby's in the stroller and he's moving, he's happy. So I like calls. And I think that they can be, you know, you can use whatever software you want to run them, Skype, Zoom, whatever. Uber Conference is one that I like because it actually automatically transcribes the conversation and it pulls out the kind of emotional language automatically. That's not an extra paid thing with that product. So I like that one. But yeah, ultimately it can just be picking up the phone and dialing their phone number. I know that that's almost unheard of these days, but that's to me the one because it's easy for the person to participate in. I find that when people are not looking you eye to eye, they're sometimes more open and they'll share more intimate details than they might if you were looking directly at them. So it feels a bit more intimate and they don't feel as nervous to share on a call.
They don't feel judged.
That's right. Yeah. So that's my favorite way.
Right. You know, you're the second person who said, I would love to go and do phone calls. The first person I heard this from was John Miller of Marketo. Mm-hmm. And you are the second person. That's amazing. Looks like the most productive people pick up the phone. Right. So here's the final rapid fire question. As a marketer, which side of the fence are you on? Is it sales and marketing led or product led or founder led? And why?
I mean, I think it all depends, right? I think that at the end of the day, we're all looking for one answer because one answer makes us sleep way better at night. Oh, we're doing the product-led approach. That's got to be right. Or like, you know, we're doing the narrative-led approach and we're focused on story. I'd say that Drift took that approach and like, look how well that worked for them.
It's almost become like, are you part of the blue state or red state?
Exactly. And I think at the end of the day, this is something that my friends, Claire and Gia from Forget the Funnel talk about a lot, but it's about being customer led, right? That's the first approach. And that will inform a lot about the strategy you choose to use, whether that be a product led or that marketing led or sales led. And at the end of the day, it also depends on the skills that your team has, right? If the founding team, oftentimes the way that a company comes to grow is because they had early talent or founding team members who had particular skill sets. You know, David Cancel from Drift was coming from HubSpot. He was a killer marketer. No surprise, marketing became their approach for growth, right? Whereas a lot of highly technical teams, like the teams at Stripe, for instance, are no surprise that they were engineering led, right? And product led. So it depends on the skills that your team has. It depends on the customers that you're going after and how they like to buy. Marketers like being marketed to. Like engineers like hearing about a product from their friends and immediately being able to go in and check it out and see the value and not feel like they're being marketed to and all that marketing BS. So it depends on your customers, also depends on the skills your team has. And really, there is no one way.
Right, I agree. And I think you should have this as your title for your next book, Marketers Like to Be Marketed.
It's true. We do. Like marketers, we say that we hate marketing. But if you look at a lot of the products that are targeted towards marketers that have become the dominant one in their category, oftentimes they're doing a lot of marketing-led growth.
Amazing. Right. You know, Caitlin, you have hit all the five rapid fire questions out of the park. That's fantastic. Great job.
Thank you. This is so much fun.
Amazing. And, you know, thank you so much for spending time and sharing your nuggets of wisdom with what you have done in the trenches. That's fantastic. But before I say my thank you and let you go, I would like to ask you, is there a parting message that you would like to share with our audience? Our audience is predominantly B2B SaaS marketers and salespeople with at least 5+ years of experience.
Yes, I would say, and this is a broken record. I'm sure other people have said it on the show. I'm just going to reiterate it. The best marketers aren't the ones who know the most about some tool or tactic or strategy like ABM. They're the ones who know the best most about their customers. And there's two sides to that coin. There's going out and learning from your actual buyers and learning why they buy, how they buy, what resonates with them. And then there's also learning about the very interesting and complex nuance of the human brain and behavioral economics, buyer psychology, marketing science, whatever you want to call it. I think that that's going to become a more and more dominant focus for marketers because it just helps make our work better. It gives us reference points to evaluate what we're doing. And so spend time learning about the new channels, learning about the new tools, but don't forget to spend time learning about customers and learning about how customers think, what makes them tick, click, and buy, because those are the insights that are going to make your campaigns really successful, not the, you know, MarTech stack you use or the channel you put the message on.
Wow, that's an amazing message. And I'm not surprised that you're friends with Rory.
Yeah, he's such an inspiring guy.
Yeah, absolutely he is. He's a legend. And where can people find you and what are the best reasons to connect with you?
I'm really nerdy. I hang out a lot on Twitter. That's definitely where I spend the bulk of my time. And that's where we should connect. Follow me there. And if you have any questions from this episode, please like let me know. Shout out. And I always respond there. And if you want a 3-minute workout for your brain to help you learn buyer psychology, get on my newsletter. And every week I send out a new tip. I use examples of real campaigns, how people can apply this to their own work. And I've got some exciting and cool things happening on that side of the business that I can't chat about right now because they're still very early days, but there's going to be some cool stuff coming on that front too.
That is amazing. Thank you so much, Caitlin. You know, it's an hour well spent and it felt like chatting with a friend with whom I resonate a lot. So thank you so much for your time.
Ditto. I felt the exact same. Thank you for having me, Ed.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us in this episode. And until we connect with you the next time with another guest and another topic, this is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.